All right. Good morning, everyone. So last but not least, a seventh paper with a very big name, but about fairly small firms, actually. So this is a paper that does not speak to IFRS. This is a paper that speaks to IFRS for SMEs. The author team here is Niklas Hellman, who is here in the room as well. Jamil Najjar, also from the School of Economics, and myself, Milda Tilaite. And well, it's a pleasure to be here and to present this paper here. So let me start with a bit of a background here. When it comes to our knowledge or our sort of idea of what small private firms or private firms in more general sense want from their reporting. And here we have a continuum of views, really, where on one extreme end, we have this view that private firms pretty much only care about their tax outcomes. And so their financial reporting choices are driven to a large extent or almost entirely by those tax payment considerations. On the other end, and so we have some evidence supporting this notion, right? Both in earnings management literature and also in some investigations on very specific accounting choices for impairments. On the other end, we have this view that there are firms that do want to prepare information that is useful and relevant to the external user of the financial statements, and these firms then adopt IFRS in a voluntary manner in a European setting, or if we move to the US, then they voluntarily prepare for their financial statements under US GAAP. But so we have these two extremes, but really it turns out that our understanding of what private firms, and especially smaller private firms, want from their reporting, do they have this external reporting orientation at all, or is it really just tax for them? And if it's not just tax, then what is it that they want to report in their financial statements? That is still sort of a largely open question, it seemed to us. And then if we bring in the an additional dimension is that, well, private firms are usually legal entities, and legal entities are a tax subject. So if there is a tax effect of their accounting choices, then that also must play a role in their decisions. And so we had these three questions in mind, and we decided to just go and investigate them in a Swedish setting, where in 2014 we had this big accounting regulation change when firms essentially needed to disclose their preference to reporting. Are they more tax oriented or are they more external reporting oriented? And so we just investigate that. And so our hope here is that this paper speaks to the relevance of the IFRS for a standard similar to IFRS SMEs, the demand of such standard among small firms, but also it has some implications for our understanding of how the links between the financial and tax reporting affect firms' choices in their accounting. Right. So let's start with the setting. We are talking about this Swedish reporting overhaul in 2014. So what was happening before is that we had a situation of competing guidance in terms of private firm reporting, where in some areas there was very little guidance on how firms should report. In some areas there was conflicting guidance on how firms should report. But ultimately there was no specific standard, no specific set of rules that firms had to follow, and rather firms could just pick and choose really what they wanted. So in principle, two relatively similar firms could have fairly different accounting outcomes, primarily due to these choices. And so in late 2012, the Swedish Accounting Standards Board issued a standard called K3, which was largely based on IFRS for SMEs 2009 edition. And now the focus of this study, so we had a lot of different types of firms that were subject to different rules here and different application requirements. But our focus here is these small legal entities there at the top. And these entities were given a choice. They could either go for this K3 IFRS for SMEs based standard, or they could go for a simpler standard, which is it was tax rules based, essentially, that there was very little deviation from the tax accounting there in that approach. So this gives us the sort of disclosed preference, right? We can observe what they want to report. Now, I have repeated small very many times, so let's define what small is. The size thresholds that were applied in this case follow the EU thresholds that probably are familiar to many of you. So a small firm is defined as a firm that lands under two out of these three thresholds for 2 years in a row, right? So if you're a company that has an asset size of under 4 million euros, approximately, it's expressed in Swedish crowns, of course, but you know, for simplicity, we go for euros here. If your revenue is under 8 million and or your number of employees is less than 50, you are classified as a small firm. So in our sample, we identify these firms. We exclude the smallest, the micro firms there that we have on the left hand side, because those are the ones that really only care about their tax filings that we sort of observed empirically. And so we decided to exclude those. And in those small firms, from those small firms, we choose those that are independent legal entities, right? So it's the entity that does not have a parent. It's not a part of the group. It's not a parent itself. And we land to a bit over 4,000 of such firms in the sample. So now these are the firms that make their account. They are small. They are not micro. They are legal entities. They do not prepare consolidated financial statements, which means that their accounting choices in some cases will also affect their tax outcomes because of the tax accounting links that these legal entities that are tax subject are subject to, right? So we go on investigating these 4,130 firms. Now, the choice between K2 and K3, we need to talk about that a little bit more as well. And so if I were to summarize this as well, K2 is aligned with tax reporting and it's simpler. It requires less disclosure. It is less costly to prepare. And K3, in contrast, is more complex. It is based on IFRS for SME, so this is where the relevance comes in. It requires more disclosure and it is more costly to prepare, right? And so for those of you that are maybe a bit more visual, this is a presentation of the guidance that PwC prepared. So this one is for K2. This one is for K3. So even the cover is thicker for K3, as you can see. So there is quite a bit of a difference there. Now, there are, central to this forum here, there is this one very big and important, there are multiple differences, of course, between these two standards, but one that is very big is the treatment of internally generated intangible assets, right? So this is the first row in this table. Under K2, all the research and development costs need to be expensed immediately. And so in that regard, it does what IFRS for SMEs currently does, right? Under K3, firms are given a choice between an expense model and the capitalization model. Under the expense model, all these costs need to be expensed immediately. But under the capitalization model, the development costs can be capitalized and accounted for as internally generated intangible assets. Now, the interesting bit here is that this choice, because there is no explicit tax rule for how R&D expenses are to be treated, that means that what you do for accounting purposes, for the financial statement purposes, also transfers to your tax outcomes. So there is a tax consequence here, and for the firms that invest more than they depreciate, to these internally generated intangible assets, this means an accelerated tax schedule as well. We also have some major difference that we can capture using historical data, which is accounting for property, plant, and equipment, where in under K2 we have tax accounting. There is no revaluation available. It's sort of a fairly simple standard. Under K3, there is more flexibility for accounting for this property, plant, and equipment. There is revaluation permitted. And most importantly, there is a component approach applied, which means that some of the expenses can also be capitalized there. There is no tax consequence of this choice, but there is a higher administrative cost, right? So these are the two big differences that we initially were interested in here. Right. So now when we start our analysis in this context, the first question was that we asked was, okay, so how many firms among these small firms, among these 4,130 firms, actually chose K-Free, right? So what is the orientation of these firms? And so to do so, we apply the state-of-the-art technique of counting. We go to the annual reports, we read the notes, we identify which standard they have chosen, because all the firms had to actually identify that. And so we land at a lovely number of 14%. So among these small private firms, legal entities, not a part of the group or anything, 14% have chosen K-Free, the standard that is essentially IFRS for SMEs with some variation. And so this is, a number is just a number, right? We can put it in a little bit of a context. We also asked the Swedish standard setter what their estimate was of this adoption rate, if you will, among these small firms, before giving them this one, of course. And their guess was that it cannot be possibly more than 5%, right? So even the standard setters themselves did not expect that there will be much demand for this type of reporting among these smaller firms. But well, empirically, we observed that it's quite a bit bigger demand than we expected. All right, so we have this this frequency of adoption. We see that generally there is this external orientation, if you will. And then the next thing that we do, we want to understand what are the key drivers here, right? So we can start from the right-hand side for you here, where we have this sort of general understanding that if the firm has external credit financing, they probably will want to report better. This is something that we talk about a lot. So we include that into the models. We also include some proxies for more diverse ownership. So we think that if there is an external CEO, externally hired CEO, or the board size is bigger, or there's a Big Four auditor, these are all signals that this firm is externally oriented, right? So we just control for these aspects because we think that these should be important drivers of K-Free adoption. But then we look at these accounting choices and the differences between the K2 and K3. So we have the internally generated asset reporting there. And so we think that if the firm has been reporting internally generated intangible assets in 2013, if this is actually important to them, then this will be an important driver for K3 adoption as well. We have similar reasoning for property, plant, and equipment. And so these two areas are where the K2 and K3 treatment differs quite substantially for these asset categories. And then, as I started with the tax focus in these private firms, and our view that firms are tax-oriented, and since accounting choices here in this setting would have tax consequences, we also try to capture this tax orientation of firms. And so what we do here is we expect that if the firm has a high tax burden measured as current tax over sales, so some sort of a operating tax burden measure, if you will, this firm will be more focused on managing that tax burden, and so they will be more inclined to report under K2 and choose K2. And we have similar reasoning for discretionary allocations to untaxed reserves. So in a Swedish setting, we have this rule that legal entities can allocate up to 25% of their pre-tax profit to untaxed reserves, essentially delaying a payment the tax payment on that part of the profit for 6 years. So we expect that if the firm is doing this, this sort of shows their tax orientation, their tax management efforts. And if that's the case, then we expect that this firm will also is more likely to adopt K2. They are more tax focused than they are external reporting focused. And so with all of this, we run some simple logistic regressions modeling the choice in 2014 on the basis of the on the financial statement values and other properties of these firms in 2013. We of course have a lot of controls and all of that. It's not here in the slide, but it's in the paper, of course. So the biggest thing that we see is that internally generated intangible assets, the present of those assets in 2013, is a very, very strong driver of this key-free adoption choice. This is something that the firms really pay a lot of attention to. Then we move to property, plant, and equipment, right? This is where we also had this difference in accounting treatment between the two standards. We don't see much choice here. So this actually contradicted our expectation, but we will come back to that a little later. Then we look at these tax orientation measures, and unexpected, we see that if we, based on our measures, if we classify the firm as more tax-oriented, this is the firm that is also more likely to move towards K2 and not K3. What is very interesting is that we don't see any effect, or significant effect at least, of external credit financing. So the presence of bank debt or the level of bank debt doesn't seem to play a role here in this accounting choice, which was also not in line what we expected based on our prior insights and on the topic. And, well, of course, these external orientation measures as Big Four auditor and external CEO and board size, they all increase the probability of K3. So this is a sort of a sanity check, if you will, in what is happening, right? So these are a lot of coefficients, and we decided to translate them into a bit more sort of understandable probabilities of adoption. And so we then follow an average firm, right? So these are conditional probabilities. And so we start off at the top row there. We start with the firm that does not report any internally generated intangible assets in 2013, and it doesn't have any tax preference. So it does not have high tax burden, and it does not use the tax allocations. So for such a firm, everything else held an average, the probability of adopting K3 is about 15.6%. Now, if we move to a firm that does not have these internally generated intangible assets, but has a strong tax preference, the probability drops by more than 30%, right, to about a 10% probability of adopting this. And now, so we see that there is sort of this tax effect coming into place here. What is interesting now is that if we go to the third row, where we have a firm that does report internally generated intangible assets in 2013, the probability of such firm adopting K3, everything else held on average, is around 50%, right? So it drops, it jumps by more than three times relative to the first row there. And then when we introduce the tax preferences, this tax orientation, then the probability of K3 adoption goes down again, even for those firms that do have internally generated intangible assets. So we see this dynamic, and what is particularly interesting here is how important the internally generated intangible assets are here in this choice, right? So we can see here this even from these numbers in the table. Now, we had those regressions, we had that analysis, but well, we have been in this business for a long time, so we understand the problems with endogeneity, the fact that all these firms that we're looking at prior to the K3 adoption, they could already do what they wanted to do, right? They could choose the accounting approach that they wanted to. There are a lot of things that are going on that we suffer from in archival research. So we decided to explore this further via a survey. So what we did here is that we identified all firms that were voluntary K3 adopters, so legal, independent legal entities that are classified as small, around the time of K3 adoption. We identified their CEOs or chairpersons of the board, and we sent out a survey to them asking various different things about K3 adoption choices and the reasons for those choices. We got a response rate of about 37.5%, out of which most were usable responses. So these are the responses that I will now go through a little bit to show how the thinking worked there, if you will. So we have a lot of, we have more analysis in this in the paper, of course, but I want to highlight two aspects here. The first one is who the initiators of the K3 choice were. And there, quite unsurprisingly, we see that it was primarily auditors and accountants that suggested K3 and not K2. But what is interesting is who was not an initiator here, and that's the banks. Right? So it was only one or two respondents that answered that it was actually